baby chicks mailed by the National Postal Service, animal testing lab whistleblowers getting threatened by mysterious powers, polar bears allowed to be hunted despite being in danger of extinction. This is Canada in 2025 as it faces what could be the most consequential election in its history, fighting an economic war with Trump's United States. In today's episode, I am joined by the inspiring Liz White, leader of the Animal Protection Party of Canada, for one of the few conversations exploring what is at stake for the billions of animals whose fate will soon be decided at the ballot box.
You know, we live in unusual times and people are very afraid of what's going to happen. We have no idea what Mr. Trump south of the border is going to do at any given time. And so things are kind of in somewhat of a chaos. And so, you know, we're looking at unprecedented times in many ways. I don't think in all the years that I've been in politics since the 70s that I've seen anything like this. But I would say, I think we have a very real opportunity here to separate ourselves out and to redefine ourselves in a way that makes us very, very different from the United States. I think we are very different, but I want to focus on the animal issue. In a way, we're different because, say, for animal agriculture, the size of the farms are much smaller than the United States. And we have, I think, probably stricter rules about how farmed animals are handled, but those aren't always followed or enforced. And so, you know, we have very difficult situations with farm animals in Canada, but to a much lesser extent than the United States. And then that gives us a very real opportunity to begin to pivot away from animal agriculture, particularly intensive animal agriculture to begin with, and then to pivot away from animal agriculture altogether as our commitment to, in part, reducing our contribution to global warming and our contribution to animal rights and animal welfare in Canada. And I think we have a very real opportunity to do that because many of our animals go to the United States. Our pigs, pork goes to the United States. All sorts of animals are transported to the United States. Sows that no longer give birth are transported to the United States for slaughter. I mean, all kinds of things are happening in this particular situation. And again, on the chicken side, all kinds of chickens that are from forced molting and egg-laying farms, spent hens, are shipped up to to Canada for slaughter, and none of that really needs to happen. We can say, with regard to the tariffs, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And I think we begin to redefine how we do animal agriculture in Canada. So I think we have a very real opportunity. With regard to animals in research, I don't see anything really changing substantially in that regard. Under the current circumstances, but maybe with the turmoil that it has caused, with the inability for research to continue as it was in the United States, we may have an opportunity to change that as well. So I look on it with dread in some ways and with opportunity in other ways.
And what about the activism scene? Do you feel or think that the animal rights activism seen in Canada is less developed than in the US or more so? Can you also differentiate, you know, those two worlds of activism?
From my point of view, the work that people do covertly in labs makes it very much harder to get information out about what's happening. I've done multiple Freedom of Informations at the federal level, the ATIP program, but predominantly in Ontario because they have an animal Animals for Research Act, and the Animals for Research Act is under the FOIP, Freedom of Information process, so I can do freedom of information for that. The standard line for denying me any information is the threat of violence against researchers, research laboratories, their homes, their families. And so most of the information that would be very helpful in fighting to get an end to this process is completely denied. And it makes it very, very difficult to actually get at the problem. The rest of Canada is a serious problem because they do not have any act that governs them. They're under the Canadian Council on Animal Care, which is a voluntary body, and frankly, not much help when even we know that there's issues going on within a particular facility or within a particular government agency, and we lay a complaint. Those are, as far as I can tell, are never really dealt with. So we have a very difficult road to hoe. I think it would be difficult anyway, but the difference in the United States is that they have sunshine laws, and so they're able to get much more information about what goes on, for example, in research laboratories, and then be able to expose them to the public. And there's an assumption that all of that information in the United States should be public, really. I don't know whether that's the case right at the moment because they're in the process of dismantling some of the research facilities and their work. But in the end, there has been a long history in the United States of getting that information out, where in, it's kind of opposite, where in Canada, it's almost impossible to get information out about what's going on in research laboratories. Now, when it comes to animal agriculture, which is another biggie, right? Those are two big, confinement issues and end of life issues and so on. The farms in the United States have, or some of the states in the United States have, of course, passed ag-gag laws, and some of those have been challenged and overturned. In Canada, of course, in Ontario, the provincial government here implemented an ag-gag piece of legislation. It's currently going through the courts. We are there as interveners. Animal Justice leading it, but we're there as interveners. And so we'll see what happens with that particular situation. But I think part of the law has already been struck down, and I suspect that other part of the law might in fact be struck down as well. I think we have a very strong argument. So slowly we're picking away at it, but it's extremely difficult in Canada to get information about what is actually going on, not in an overall general sense because the CCAC provides us with that, but in a research facility by research facility. In the FOI material that I got from the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs that governs the Animals for Research Act, I was able to get heavily redacted information from each research facility in Canada and the inspection reports that took place in those facilities. And the inspection reports showed that in many cases, the research facilities were in non-compliance with the regulations that were set out in the Animals for Research Act. And in fact, some were in violation of those, not just in non-compliance, but in violation of those. And so you wonder if that is what you're seeing out of a heavily redacted document, what's actually going on in those facilities? And so far, we haven't been able to find out. Yeah, so one of the interesting examples of how hard it is to get information, we had a situation where a student or students entered Arkell Research Facilities, which is at the University of Guelph. And they do research on farmed animals, basically. And they found that the door was open and nobody was inside, except the animals, of course, who are somebody. And they went through and documented the condition of the animals, which were pretty grim. And I think pretty much unacceptable for a research facility in Ontario under the Animals for Research Act. So they posted, they took pictures, they posted on Facebook. I reached out to them and asked if I could lay a complaint based on their photos and their information. They agreed. I laid complaints to the university, OMAFRA, and at the federal level, and was denied all information about what was going on there, even though, you know, the chickens were in really terrible condition and the pigs were. And why we were denied that information is beyond me, but it just goes to show you how difficult it is to get any information out about what's occurring to these animals. So, you know, when we get good examples like that, we continue to build on the pressure to the research facilities, to the farm animals, to get changes.
You mentioned how researchers get threatened. Did I hear that correctly? And, who is doing the threatening?
Well, that's the interesting thing, Rayanne. I get denied information based on one-liner, you know, threats of violence and intimidation. So I've written to the IPC, to OMAFRA, to the CCAC to please tell me what are the incidents and who's doing it. And they won't tell me. So I know, but I know from doing a Freedom of Information request to St. Mike's Hospital, because they use animals there, that they challenged my request based on being persecuted, intimidated, and worried about violence. And so I dug around a little bit, and actually in their report, they said that outside of the facility, which they not list on list, the address where the animals come in, they do all that, so all that's public. And yet they're afraid because somebody wrote in chalk on the sidewalk, what was it? Something about animals dying on level 8 of the facility. And that was what they used. And a reporter came to their door to ask for more information about what was going on to the animals. And that's what they used as intimidation. And so I have not been able to get an answer since then as to who's doing the intimidation and what's the level of the intimidation. So we don't really know.
That's crazy.
Crazy. Yep. You're not allowed to know what's going on in the research laboratory, who's doing it, where the animals are coming from, what they're subjected to, and if there is a threat, what kind of threat there is and who's doing it. You can't have any of that information.
I guess in there's an implicit confession of, there's an implicit understanding that if you had access to that information and you were able to expose it and present that to Canadians, then they would side with you and make those practices stop. Isn't there, this implicit understanding?
I think the interesting information about this particular issue, and maybe even farmed animals, those are the, you know, really big, where the big numbers are, that certainly with the research issue, most people just don't believe it's happening. I mean, it is a huge barrier to get over. We went from a broader campaign to a much narrower campaign talking about pets going to research, animals that end up in pounds and shelters, are requisitioned by research facilities, and they get the animals and they do research on them. And people just cannot believe that that happens. And yet, the statistics from the Canadian Council on Animal Care show large numbers of pet animals, companion animals, are sent to research, and in fact, some of the most painful research is done on them. And yet, you know, trying to get people to understand that actually happens and how it happens, because it's so secretive, is really impossible. And so it makes, you know, going after change in these situations a challenge.
So years and years ago, I was an activist for an organization. I was volunteering for them and on a campaign about tax havens. I learned a lot about tax havens and how different countries are different kinds of tax havens for different industries. And I guess my question is Canada like a special place for the ag or animal exploitation industry? Like, if you are in big pharma and you want to experiment on animals and do some of the worst experiments out there, is Canada one of the best place to do so because of that barrier to access of information and how they are allowed to, because I feel like they're really empowered here.
I think partly that's the case, and partly it's just how the research community worldwide works. As long as you can shut down any conversation about they are less exposed to what they're doing and less having to have a conversation that maybe they should change, that maybe they might want to look at NAMs, the non-animal alternatives, of which there are many in place now, and many that are being developed by people who are doing alternative science in that regard. I think where Canada becomes a haven, and it's not really a haven, I think it's sloppy work on the part of our government, and maybe that makes us a haven. But I think a good example of that is the trade-in long-tailed macaque monkeys from Cambodia. Under the CITES, the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, if you're going to use monkeys for research, you have to have them from a breeding facility, not from the wild. And of course, with things like COVID and other viruses floating around, they're used for that kind of research. There is huge pressure to get more and more macaque monkeys. And so Charles River, which is one of the largest facilities in the United States, and I think one of the only that imports macaque monkeys, was under investigation by the US Fish and Wildlife Service. And in fact, they found that they are alleged to have imported monkeys from the wild. And so they have been denied bringing any monkeys into the United States. So Charles River, who has a company here, simply moved their import into Canada, and Canada's become the largest importer of long-tailed macaque monkeys into Canada. And the more than a suspicion, I would say, exists that these animals came from the wild, not from a breeding facility. Because if you look at the number of females in a breeding facility, the length of time it takes for them to have babies, the length of time it takes them to raise them so that they can be used for research. The numbers of monkeys that are coming through simply outpace what a breeding facility or breeding facilities can produce. So we know they're caught from the wild, and that's the issue. And CITES is taking a look at it, but it makes you feel like Canada has become a safe haven, that in fact the our folks in the Ministry of the Environment are not really looking very hard at the documentation of these monkeys and where they came from.
And then I guess, like you alluded to, is it, willfulness from them, or is it just sloppiness? Is it just incompetence, or are they really understanding the issue and turning a blind eye on purpose, because they have been captured by this industry?
I think they're just looking at the paperwork. The paperwork says captivity. And we know, I mean, the difficulty is this issue of reliability of information from Cambodia. And so, what the US Fish and Wildlife has alleged to have found is that those documents were not true. And when they asked Charles River to prove where these animals came from, Charles River stopped importing into the US and brought it into Canada. So, you think down there, I think interestingly, before Trump got in, the US Fish and Wildlife Service did a good job at actually taking it on, investigating it, looking at it. I mean, PETA was actually involved in producing some of the information, but the US Fish and Wildlife Service actually did a sting operation and all that sort of stuff. So I think they did their due diligence. I think Canada just looks at the paperwork and says, okay.
To continue on this comparison between the US and Canada, something the US has that is an envy, I guess, for me, is freedom of speech. And it's a constitutional right. It's their, I think, First Amendment. But we don't really have something like that in Canada. And what is the impact of that for activism and for animal rights activists in Canada?
Well, I think the ag-gag legislation that's being challenged in court in Ontario is a good example of, it's going to probably have to go to the Supreme Court. Whether the Supreme Court actually agrees to look at it is a whole other thing. But if they do agree to look at it, then we may be able to lay a marker through the Constitution about free speech and about the ability of people to actually document the condition of animals and how they're treated legally and not be constantly harassed and thrown in jail. The farmers argue that if people go into the barns, it contaminates the animals. But when you look at the actual facts of the case, none of those animals are discarded. They go to slaughter and they're eaten. So there's clearly not a problem with contamination of the animals or spreading disease. And so, their argument for doing that is out the window. So we'll see what happens. And that may have, winning that case in total may have a substantial impact on the ability of people to talk out about things and to actually document things. But that's just Ontario. Now, as the courts function, they often refer to cases that are outside of their jurisdiction. Something comes up in Alberta and there's a challenge about free speech. Somebody may use the issue from Ontario to bolster their case, but it largely, I think, affects Ontario. It may affect beyond that. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't really know.
Talking about contamination, I followed closely the work of activists in the US who documented what's happening on the avian influenza front and that epidemic and how it affected and still affects the industry. Have we been impacted by this epidemic? Because I did not see, news outlets covering the price of eggs in Canada or something like that.
BC was the hardest hit, and we've killed, I think, 1 million chickens in Canada. I'm not sure exactly of the number, but it's huge. And of course, that wouldn't take a long time to come because many of the barns have 40, 50, 60,000 chickens in them. And it depends, I guess, on whether they're egg layers or whether they're raised to be eaten quickly, broilers, they call them. They've had to kill many, many, many chickens. It's affected a number of barns in BC. And they had to hire contract out people to do the killing. in some of the barns because the CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, couldn't handle it. And what they found was that those people who are not particularly trained in doing this job were contaminating non-contaminated barns when they traveled from barn to barn and spreading the virus. So there was a report about that. So it was not particularly well done, and we really don't have the facilities to do it. And beyond that, it is one of the cruelest way to kill animals. They basically suffocate them. They often use foam to suffocate them. So you think about what those birds go through, not because of their fault, but because of the fault of people around them and the way in which they're raised and so on. And the cruelty is incredible. And try to get information out about how that takes place, what it looks like. Do they have pictures? It's a no-go.
This is a very niche question, but what do you make of this new trend? Maybe it's not new, but it feels like it's a new trend in the past years of having backyard chickens. There were laws passed in many Quebec cities here that authorize people to keep chickens in their backyard. But that, don't you think there is a risk of contamination with this whole, avian influenza thing? Are we playing with fire, by allowing people to keep chickens in their backyard?
I actually think we're playing with fire. Yes. We were able to get the City of Toronto to back off the bylaw that we're allowing chickens in the backyard. It was a big fight because people wanted those chickens. And it's a like you think about it, just you rent them. You don't think, you rent your these little animals and you rent the housing for them and you stick them in your backyard and you love them for a few months until they stop laying, then you send them back. And nobody knows what happens to them. The owners of some of the rent-a-chicken facilities say, oh, well, we take care of your chickens and love them, and you'll get your same chickens back. But nobody really knows. And, and beyond that, what is also shocking to many people is that we mail chicks out to people who want backyard chickens. So we put them in Canada Post and mail them. And you look at this whole situation, not only is it cruel and ridiculous because the eggs cost about $2 an egg, they it is also the cruelty and the insanity of it. But yes, you're playing with fire. It's like that avian influenza is very, very contagious, and you can't stop other birds from coming into your backyard with the chickens. And and that's how the contamination happens. So the City of Toronto decided to ban it altogether, which was great. But many other communities are going on as though nothing's happening. And the problem with avian influenza is it's transmitting to other animals. And it's been transmitted to people from animals. It hasn't transmitted from people to people yet, but this is a virus that is evolving. And somehow we think that it's all good and that nothing's going to happen. And we could be in a situation like COVID all over again, and much more serious because there are no vaccines for it. And I think we're just playing with fire. So yeah, I would recommend every community in Canada ban backyard chickens.
What do you mean by mailing chicks?
Well, they put them in a box, they seal the box, they put a stamp on it, and they put it in Canada Post. Chicks, live chicks.
And is it only an Ontario thing? Like, is there a limit to how many
It's
days?
Canada Post. Canada Post does it, required to do it.
And they could spend days in that box.
Well, they indicate that there's something live in the box. So it's supposed to get moving. But you can imagine we had a strike. It happened at a time when the chicks aren't moving, but we had a strike. If that had happened in the summertime, the chicks would have died. They would have simply starved to death or suffocated. You look at this thing and you think that's just cruelty. There's no way around it. You can't do this, and yet it's accepted as a standard way to get chicks. We've tried to fight it, but it hasn't. We haven't been successful at this point. It's pretty shocking what we do to animals, isn't it?
I don't know what to say. I think I've been vegan for the last 10 years. I'm still shocked by the level of cruelty and what it means, really, what it means to treat people, sentient beings, as objects.
Yep. Well, our standards, at least in the United States, are lowering because we're allowed to steal people off a sidewalk, send them to a detention center, and then ship them to another country to their prison system. You look at that situation and you think, what we're doing to, if what we do to human beings is acceptable, our own species, why do we think it's going to be different for animals that look for species look different from us, behave differently, communicate differently? People look at them and don't know what to make of them. And we're lucky in the sense that we have a fairly large community of people who are compassionate. And want to make a change. And so we need to keep working at that. We have to, get up out of bed every morning, even if we don't want to, face the day and face the awful situation that animals go through. But we have to do it so that we never give up on this issue and we never give up on trying to protect the animals that we know are subjected to abuse, misuse, cruelty, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, I think the difference is when we talk about human rights, there's a much larger network of people and organizations and so much funding dedicated to shedding light on those issues. But you could be a vegan of 10 years living in Canada and not even be aware that there are chicks being mailed by Canada Post. The information that how it is all done in darkness and silence, it's and in indifference of the public. It's that's I think the real difference between human rights and animal rights.
I think that's why the Animal Protection Party of Canada is so important. It's the only animal protection party in Canada. And we've been around since 2006. And it's small because we live in a first past the post system. But if you look at Party for the Animals in the Netherlands, where they have proportional representation, they've actually elected representatives to the European Union, to the European Parliament. They have elected officials to their national government and all the way down to local governments. It's done differently than we do here. So, but they are have been able to expose and have documentation that they have access to. They get government money because they're a political party and they have representatives elected. And they've begun a real active, aggressive debate in the Netherlands about animals and the environment and the cruelty. And we have a real opportunity to do it here. And that's why the Animal Protection Party is participating in another challenge, charter challenge, which is the proportional representation. Fair Voting BC and Springtide are the two entities that are leading the charge in that. We've participated by donating to the cause, and we're going, when it gets to the Supreme Court, if it does, we will ask to be interveners as the only political party that's there talking about this issue, if you can imagine.
I think that's if we want to close that conversation about the difference between the US and Canada, I think that's what the US will never have, the hope of a proportional democratic system where an animal protection party can reach power. Yeah. But we do have that hope. And yeah. if we can get there, I do think you have convinced me that it would be, checkmate, and we could make a really huge impact.
Yeah. We're the, oh, just for an example, in this election, Pierre Poilievre says he's going to open up the seal hunt again. No markets, no anything. They're talking about grinding them up for fertilizer. And we're the only party that has a position on it. Other than the Conservatives who want to increase it. So I think, we are able to participate fully in the election. We can take out ads and talk about the seal hunt and so on. So, we're able to actually on the ground during that very critical time when people are more actively looking at alternatives. We're there to provide that alternative if they so choose.
Yes, and so I want to spend a moment talking about wildlife. You mentioned seals, which is, I've been hearing about that long before I was even vegan. People don't want to see that. They don't want, seal hunting. Seals are just the cutest creatures out there. And the way they hunt them, it's just the most, barbaric thing you could ever watch, the footage of that. So how is it that it's not, more of a popular political issue? I feel like political parties could, make it an issue and gain lots of popularity with voters.
Well, there's a couple of things. This issue has been going on for a very, very long time. And a colleague of mine, Stephen Best, and Barry Mackay worked on the initial fight, and it was a big issue. It was huge, huge debate. And ultimately, they won a ban on the import of white coats, the very, very, the babies of the seals. And that's what they were after originally, taking the white coats, because that was the most sought after fur. Once they're past the white coat stage, which is in about 2 or 3 weeks, they become what they call beaters, and their fur is very stiff, silvery, blotchy, not really the kind of fur that's going to really acquired by people who want to wear fur coats. So they then became, when that happened, the seal industry went down the tubes for a while. And then under the Liberal Party, it came back in a huge way. It was, they set the kill at 340,000 seals, I think. And they never reached that amount, but they took an awful lot of seals out of that. And that's again when they went to the European Union, European Parliament, to say, would you consider, this is too high a number, it's affecting the seal population. Global warming is happening. The seals need ice to have their babies on, and the ice is disappearing. Could you ban the import of seal products into the European Union? And in fact, they did. And that brought the seal hunt down again. There is a challenge at the European Parliament as to whether they're going to reopen and consider retaking the seal products. But I think there's enough opposition in Europe that that's not going to happen. So, these animals are being killed because and there's no market. And if Polyev opens the market, there'll be even more animals killed, and there's no market.
The last time, not the last time, but the time before, the first time you appeared on the show, we talked about also the bears and the market for, hunting bears, and how it was even international. We have people from all over the world, mostly the US, coming to Canada to hunt bears. Has there been any evolution in that regard? And do you think that with a conservative government, hunting bears and hunting in general would be, more open and less restrictive and more, indifferent to animal welfare?
Under the Conservative Party, really, they haven't done a lot of changes to the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Act. The only thing that they did, which was egregious, totally egregious, is that the fishermen don't like cormorants. So cormorants are big black birds that, dive in the water, eat the fish, and then they come out, they nest in trees. Their guano kills the trees. So they change the topography of the area that they are in. In Toronto, we have the largest cormorant colony in North America, right at the bottom of the city near the lake. We've been able to protect those. But in the province itself, the provincial government opened up hunting. Nobody eats cormorants. Nobody. So when they shoot cormorants, they have to waste them. So they had to amend the act to allow people to just shoot them and leave them there. If you hunt a bear, you can't waste that animal. You have to use the pelt, use the meat, all that sort of stuff. Same with deer and so on. But we had a massive victory in Ontario in quite a while ago. They prohibited bear hunting in the spring. And the problem with spring bear hunting is that often mother bears are killed and the cubs are left to be orphaned. So more than one bear dies, of course, and of course it's cruel and all that sort of stuff. So they decided at that point, under Mike Harris, actually, another conservative government, to ban the spring bear hunt, which they did. And then under Kathleen Wynne's government, they decided that they needed more northern votes, and so they opened up the spring bear hunt again. So we lost that altogether. Spring bear hunts continue. You can't hunt any other animal in the spring because they consider it to be cruel, but bears are okay. And so bears are killed in the spring and in the fall. The government doesn't really collect. They used to collect great detailed information about what type of bears were being killed. How old were they? Were they male and female? Was one a lactating female? All that sort of stuff. The other thing that they allow is baiting. So you put out a pail of donuts and honey and all sorts of things that smell good to a bear to attract them to the bait site that, and then they have to reach up to get the food out of the drum. And then the hunters say that they can tell what the sex of the bear is, so they don't shoot females. But that is in fact not the case. And of course, there are lots of females shot, and some of them lactating. So, the whole thing, and that's pretty true across Canada. And of course, in Alberta, we're talking about also hunting grizzly bears, which are small in number. That's in order to attract people from the United States to come up and hunt trophy hunting. So, from an animal protection point of view, it's pretty wicked out there for any wild animal. They tend to be persecuted by some group or other, and often hunted by some group or other. And it's very, very difficult to get it stopped.
What about the use of poison to kill wildlife?
That's now, so we started that campaign quite a long time ago. In fact, it was right at the very beginning of Animal Alliance that we took on British Columbia because they were using poisons to kill wolves and stuff. And they actually put a pause on that, and the pause has continued to this day. So the only province now, and then it used to be Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. We've been able to get stuff, strychnine that they were using to kill Richardson's ground squirrels, which they don't like in animal agriculture business, stopped. And the use of other poisons we've been able to stop. So we're now down to Alberta. Alberta used to use compound 1080 or monosodium fluoroacetate or strychnine to kill wolves and to protect caribou and to kill wolves and coyotes to protect agriculture animals, farmed animals. And we managed to get the strychnine banned. So we're now down to one province, one poison, and we're in the process of building a campaign to get that eliminated as well. I don't know whether anybody's looked at videos of this stuff, but, you know, in other countries, they often use things like strychnine and compound 80 to kill animals in cities where they've become nuisance. And so people have taken videos. And when you look at what the animal goes through after eating compound 1080 or strychnine, it's just heart-wrenching and, you know, things you can't erase from your mind. And so the faster we get this done, the better. But we've made very real progress over the last 10 or 15 years.
And a complex question I've had in mind for a long time now is, what do you make of the argument from hunters that say, hey, there is an overpopulation of this or that species in the wild, and so we need to reduce their numbers? Is there any validity to that?
We've just been working on this issue of overpopulation. You know, what the hunters, and in fact, some government agencies, the Ontario government, I believe the Quebec government at some times, and our national park system, often deem animals as being hyperabundant, overabundant, overpopulated are the various terms that they use. And you say, okay, we're looking at a dynamic ecosystem. We're looking at global warming and dynamic changes to the ecosystem. And by what measure are you determining something to be overpopulated or hyperabundant? And it's strictly based on their opinion about what a particular area is to look like. So with the cormorants on Middle Island, which is in Lake Erie in Ontario, Parks Canada deemed them to be hyperabundant on Middle Island, one island in the middle of a bunch of islands in Lake Erie, an island that nobody can go to. It was bought up by Parks Canada, or the groups that bought it transferred it over to Parks Canada under Point Pelee National Park. They determined the cormorants to be hyperabundant, and since 2008 have conducted culling programs on Middle Island so that the vegetation looks the same as it did before the cormorants came. So there's no sense of evolution in an ecosystem. There's no sense that there has to be space for animals that change topographies and ecosystems. You know, these are the type of animals that are change makers, right? That they go in and they change the environment, and people don't like what they see, so they want them gone. And what we've managed to do with a large population in Toronto, and I invite people in the summertime spring and summertime to come and go to Tommy Thompson Park and revel in the amazingness of this water bird colony in a highly dense urban environment, and they're thriving. But they agreed, the people managing them agreed to do an alternative approach. So they want to keep trees in certain areas. They don't care about trees in other areas. So they chase the cormorants out of the treed areas into the areas where they want them. They've encouraged ground nesting as opposed to tree nesting. And I think 75% of the colony now nests on the ground. And so it's been a tremendous success. So it shows you that you can do things differently. But the go-to in most of these situations where they claim hyperabundance is killing.
And we don't really hear that much about underpopulation in certain areas. We have growing cities that are eating more and more, you know, territories, ecosystems, and nobody is talking about how, you know, in those cities there's no biodiversity. There is no where are all of the species that were supposed to live there, and now it's all gray, it's all asphalted, it's all
The interesting thing about the city of Toronto is that it's highly dense, for sure, but we have lots of ravine systems and places where wildlife can hang out. And so we actually have a very rich mix of animals that can coexist with human beings and feel comfortable there. The issue becomes, of course, can human beings be comfortable with the animals? And in fact, we have one issue right now where there's a lot of development going on in along the lake, in very, very dense communities already. But Ontario Place, they're redeveloping. It was a great piece of land with trees and hardly anybody there. And so there was a lot of wildlife there. They have been disturbed and have moved into this highly dense area. In particular, it's coyotes particularly that have done this. And they are now, you know, conflicting with the residents there who want to have their dogs off the leash, let them run around, you know, do all that sort of thing, which is really great for the dogs, except that if there's a coyote in the area and the dog is little, it may be that the coyote will try and take that little dog. And if it's off leash somewhere away from you, you can't protect it. So we're going through a massive discussion about living, coexisting peacefully with coyotes. And our animal services folks are doing a really, really good job at trying to mitigate some of the conflicts. But the residents want the coyotes killed and removed. So we're into that kind of discussion. So we'll see how it evolves. But we, you know, if we can get over this hurdle, we can learn to live with coyotes in the area. And in fact, in other communities, it's been done. In other parts of Toronto, it's been done. But for some reason, we're into a real fight on this one. So these are important fights where you lay down the line and you say, no, we're going to fight this. If we lose, we lose. But, you know, we don't want to agree that the coyotes should be removed, lethally removed out of this area, because the residents don't want to put their dogs on a leash. So, you know, in the long run, I think it's really important that urban areas learn to attract, accommodate, enjoy, live with, leave alone wildlife, because we are, as you say, chewing up their, what would be their wild territory, and putting housing all over the place. So if we can build the community in a way that allows corridors, you know, forested corridors through the communities so that the animals can travel safely, they don't have to go on the road. If we can have ravines and large parks with areas that are protected from people, We can accommodate wildlife nicely and increase the diversity in our own communities and become ecologically friendly.
Kind of a weird question, but do you think that environmentalists are our allies?
No, absolutely not.
Please expand.
There isn't one environmental group that I know of that has spoken out about the cormorants. And we've been fighting this thing for 20 years. It began in culling cormorants on Middle Island began in 2008. And we're close to 20 years, 18 years or so. So nobody has spoken out about it. In fact, the groups that got together to buy Middle Island and then donate it to Parks Canada have not spoken out about it. In fact, some of the groups want the cull. They want the vegetation, they don't want the birds. And cormorants were persecuted. We're down to about 1,000 individuals because they were so persecuted. And they've made this, and then they were, the persecution stopped, but then DDT came around and they were hit with that. And so they've now made this miraculous comeback, an amazing comeback into, a couple of million birds, not a lot. And they seem to be thriving. And yet, what do we want to do? We want to persecute them and kill them again. I mean, I don't find environmental groups standing up for these sort of things, no.
And you mentioned how the Animal Protection Party is the only party wanting a proportional democratic system. So that means that excludes the Green Party.
The Green Party, I don't know what the position is. The Provincial Green Party used to have a position on proportional representation, and then I think they don't now. I'm not sure, but I'm wrong on that, actually. I think they do support proportional representation. I don't know about the federal party, but they're not participating in the court case. There's not one party other than ours that have participated in the court case. So you got to ask yourself, what is it going to take to, if Trudeau, who promised to bring in proportional representation, didn't do it, and other elected officials are not particularly supportive of the idea, then how do we get it to happen? And I don't know that the Greens have been that active in this whole fight.
Well, I don't care what they say. I want to see action. Why are you not on the front line of this legal fight?
I think when you think about it, if we had one person in Parliament, let's just say one, we would not be able to talk very much, but we would be able to talk. We would be able to ask questions, but we would be able to logically dig for information out of the party, right? Out of the government. So we could dig away at situations around the CFIA, around the expenditures and culling at Parks Canada, the research issue, the funding for research through the various entities that fund research in Canada. We could do all of that. We could start getting the information out publicly on those issues, even just having one person in Parliament. And so, you have to ask yourself, even in our movement, the animal rights movement, why are we not more electorally and politically engaged? Because they're the people who make the decisions, who lives, who dies, who suffers, by how much, how often. All of those issues are decided by governments. And we seem to think that if we just show governments how bad it is, they'll do something about it. But that's not how politics works. They look at the agricultural community, the number of votes there. They look at our organ, our our movement. They look at the people that are in the movement. They have no idea how they're going to vote. And so what's the political upside to doing anything? And, you know, the first past the post just continues to make sure that that whole idea and consideration stays in place.
Going back quickly to the environmentalists, what is their agenda exactly? Because at first, you know, I was very much, you know, aligned with them, and I'm talking before becoming vegan. But then I had an evolution in my thinking, and I felt strongly that becoming vegan was the best thing to do for the environment.
Yep.
And that's when I felt kind of a separation with the environmental movement and felt like they were not making lots of sense. And now I'm just confused, you know, what are they about?
Well, they're, you know, it's not that they're all bad. They fight, you know, they fought to protect the green space north of Toronto that Ford wanted to develop houses on. They fight for parks and for woodlots, protection of woodlots. And a lot of them do that kind of work very, very well. And that's really important because, of course, animals need a place to live. And the more of those places that we have, the better. But it's in a way, it's kind of like you defend an apartment, the maintenance of an apartment building, but you don't defend the occupants. And so, you know, do they allow hunting in these areas? Do they allow what do they allow? And in some cases, they absolutely allow hunting in the woodlots that they've protected. You know, they absolutely support Parks Canada in its culling programs. They support hunting in provincial parks by First Nations. So, you know, in a way across Canada, there is not a single area or much of a single area that animals can be in and safe. And so I think you got to ask yourself the question, you know, it's great. It's wonderful. Absolutely fantastic to save the geography. But you also have to protect the occupants of the geography to make a full-blown ecosystem work. And so I think that's where they fall down.
I love the image of defending the apartment block, the building itself, but not the occupants. I think it's, you know, exactly that. And what do you make then of environmental causes that have to do with protecting some subspecies of vegetation? Like, I care about it. I will care about it if it has an impact on the fauna, like an insect, a butterfly, something like that. But if it doesn't, then why should we care?
I think we should care about plants. They're super important in terms of the evolution of an ecosystem, the provision of food and shelter and all that sort of stuff to species that we don't even know about, like various types of insects and stuff. So I think it's really important. Where it becomes a problem is the where animals have been indigenous in the area and plants have been indigenous in the area, and the area is evolving, an unmanaged ecosystem just evolving on its own, and the animals eat the plants. I think that's the way it is. But you see, on Middle Island, Middle Island is part of a broader ecosystem that doesn't include most of Canada. It's just we're on the edge of it, the Carolinian biosphere. And so the plants on Middle Island are Carolinian. And Canada considers them endangered because they're in Canada and not they're not considering them as part of the biosphere. If you looked at the plants that they're trying to protect from the cormorants in the biosphere, they're not endangered at all. And so why are we going through this massive, cruel killing program to save plants that are not endangered? And, I think we have to figure out now how we look at an evolving ecosystem, because plants are going to disappear. We're talking about, the planet warming. We're talking about fires. We're talking about, floods. We're talking about huge ice things, wind, tornadoes and stuff. All of our ecosystem is going to evolve and change, and we need to allow the plants and the animals to begin to change what they need to change in order to survive the warming planet. And instead, we say, nope, this plant we have to protect, these birds we have to kill, these deer we have to get rid of, these coyotes have to go, all that sort of stuff. And without recognizing and without even acknowledging this tremendous change that's beginning and coming and, going to be overwhelming to many species. And the species that can accommodate to it are the species that are going to survive. We're still killing polar bears. They're still, you can go up and kill a couple, but you have to go through a process, but you can kill a polar bear when we know that their ecosystem is going. Are they going to survive or not? We don't know. But we're not giving them the best chance possible to try and survive through that, because we think it's okay to take them and use their pelts. So I sort of think we have not in any way engaged in the reality of global warming, changes to the ecosystem, impacts on animals that, we don't like, and animals that we do like. I don't know. I just think human beings have to wake up and begin to be more inclusive and sensitive to broader species in the world.
Yes, right on. And I guess to close this conversation about wildlife, there are parks, national parks in Canada that are protected. But nowadays, I'm wondering if that protection is really that established. Like, what does it mean that this piece of land is protected? And am I right to be skeptical? And I guess I could, tell the story of the place where I live. There was a wetland, location, and it was understood that this place was protected. But yet, there was a vote with the city council, and they changed the status of that land, and now they're building a apartment complex on those wetlands. And so, is it really protected?
Federally, it's legislatively protected. That doesn't mean that, it's how you interpret the protection. But generally speaking, the parks and reserves are generally protected from things like development, encroachment, all that sort of stuff. There was a discussion, in fact, in Jasper, around Jasper National Park. There was a possible ask of the federal government, could they build in the park and replace the houses that had been burnt down in the fire that went through last year? And as far as I can tell so far, the answer has been no, and it won't happen. But you look at those two major parks in Alberta, and they have a golf course, and they have hotels, and they have this. And I think they were probably taken over early on in the whole process, trying to protect from further development, which they've been able to do. I think they're probably protected. Where it isn't protected, wetlands are a real issue across the country. And they're the lifeblood of our ecosystems. And they, of course, house many, many, many wild animals, wild insects, wild everything, and they're critically important to the health of the ecosystem. And yet they are considered to be swamps, is what we used to call them, and to be drained and to be used for development. And that's happening all across the country. There's a wonderful person in Alberta whose name just escapes me at the moment. I'll think about it. But she, of course, advocates for wetlands and advocates for not trapping beaver to allow the wetlands to occur. And so, it's just an indication about how critical it is and how often communities ask for a redefinition of what a wetland is so that they can develop it. And I have to say, many of the environmentalists are on the right side of that issue and have fought hard to protect wetlands. We worked on one with the city of Montreal a while ago, and the city bought the land ultimately, and so that part of the wetland is protected, but I think there's development occurring in other parts of it, so who knows how that will ultimately end. But I think the more parks we get, the more land we get under control of the federal government. And we'll see what Carney does, but I think the more land we'll actually have protected, not perfectly, but better than just sitting there.
So, Liz, we mentioned how your work is important, and this is something since the first time I met you and we had the conversation, my thinking of animal advocacy and how to best help animals and stop this madness has evolved, and now I'm on the same page as you are about the political stuff.
Way.
And so, what can we do to support your efforts? What can we do to support the efforts of the Animal Protection Party?
I guess there's a couple of things. I would once the election, let's say the election, okay, so we'll deal with the election first. I think you should go and meet with your the candidates in your area and introduce yourself and say you're going to be back. You want to talk to them about animal issues, and you're hoping that as it goes along that they would be willing to actually introduce a private member's bill, or actually if they're in the government, get the government to introduce a bill on whatever issue you want to talk about. If you want a little bit more support in that area, you might want to go out and do a bit of canvassing for a candidate of your choice. Even if they're not the Animal Protection Party, which they won't be because we're not running that many candidates, it's really important to get a feel for how politics works. What's the wheeling and dealing behind the scenes? Who owes what, who to whom? All that sort of stuff is important. And making that personal connection with the person who gets elected in your area so that when something comes up, you can phone that person up, get a meeting with them, and talk to them about your concerns about whatever the government's doing or your support about whatever the government's doing. So that I would, it's 4 years. It'll be four. If we get a majority government, it'll be 4 years till the next election. I would urge people who are vegetarian and vegan across the country to begin to do a little bit of research into how to become a candidate. It's our goal to run more candidates. We've been up to about 20 at one time, but it was quick this time, so it was we were unable to get to that number. But if we have time to plan to consider running for the party, it's a fantastic way. You get go to all candidates meetings, you get to talk about your issue. Nobody else at the candidates meeting is going to talk about your issue, but you can. I have one on mid-April that I'm going to go to, and I'm going to talk about all the animal issues and the, because the Liberals in a way did a pretty good job, low-hanging fruit, but they did it. They got the cosmetic bill through. And they did, and some of the pesticide stuff we got through. So they did some really good stuff, but it wasn't clearly enough. It's obviously, when you start digging into animal issues, it's a tsunami of issues to try and deal with. So looking at the issues that are most important, and moving those forward. It's harder to talk about the animal agriculture because of the size of the industry. But there are alternative groups out there. There are vegan environmental agriculture people. And so, we can begin to talk about how to, as a party and as a candidate, how to shift from, the very damaging and cruel animal agriculture to a vegan agriculture. And it's much kinder to the land. You don't have to use as many pesticides and all that sort of stuff. So you can use the party and the platform, which I think is pretty fulsome, to advocate the issues that you are interested in. And if you would be interested in being a candidate 4 years coming, maybe do some research on how to do that. A lot of people find it pretty intimidating, and it is because you got to get up and talk to an audience that isn't particularly sympathetic about your issues, but it's a really, really, really good test about how well you are able to put your issues forward and whether you can convince people in the audience that you have a case.
Let me ask you a question. I actually wrote an article about social media and how social media should not become the centerpiece or the focus of animal rights activists. And, I actually took as an example the Animal Protection Party of Canada. You have, hundreds of followers on social media, yet it is difficult to transform that and to convert that into candidates in the field. So maybe I would love to hear, your thoughts on that. Why is it so difficult to get people who are sympathizers to animal protection organizations to do something out of the social media world?
I think it's become a world where you don't have to do a whole lot of work. And you see something, you post it, and you get a bunch of people commenting on it, and you comment back. And it's very passive. You can do it. Doesn't take a whole lot of work or thinking. And that's why I think it's really difficult for people to understand. How do you get legislation changed from the outside and from the inside? How do you do it? What is the mechanism by which you lobby? Who do you talk to? How often do you go there? How much do you pressure those people? What kind of information do you put in front of them? If you're going to promote an issue, you better have it to a politician. You better have it well researched because if you present them with something like, I don't like what somebody's doing, that's not going to cut it, and you will probably be ignored, and you'll wonder why. And you need to make, I think you need to make, and this may be difficult for people, but I think you need to make a really deep commitment to, if you're interested in an issue, to doing the proper research, to getting all of the scientific information lined up, to do all that kind of work so that when you go, if you decide to go to your member of parliament or member of provincial parliament to present your case, that you have it well prepared and you're skilled and the person can see that you know what you're talking about. And that takes a lot of work. And often people don't either want to do that, feel inadequate for doing it. I don't quite know, but I do know we have a couple of candidates that have just jumped in. They've just decided I'm going to do it. One in Newfoundland and one out in BC. And it's a hard, you can imagine being an animal rights person in Newfoundland, where they have the seal hunt, how difficult that is. And yet, he's going to do it. And so I think you just and he's and they're learning. They're both learning really fast, what arguments to put forward, what not, all that sort of stuff. And of course, myself and my colleague Barry McKay are there to help them. It means that these are people who are willing to actually do the work. And I think that makes all the difference in the world. And we need more people like that. And I don't know what it takes to get people out of Facebook and TikTok and Snapchat and whoever else they're on, to actually begin to do the kind of work that needs to be done to change the legislation, because that's where the change is going to happen.
What about donations? How much can we give? I think there is a ceiling to political donations.
Yeah, there's a ceiling. Yeah. It's like $1,725 or $1,750. I'm just not quite sure. It changes. It goes up by $25 every year. So you could become a month, people could become a monthly donor, and make it the 1700 and whatever it is over a 12-month period, so it isn't onerous. Some people just write us a check for the entire amount. You get a very, just for people who need tax receipts, you get an extremely good receipt from Elections Canada for donating to our party. And the sweet spot, if you give $400, you get 325 or 350 back. I can't remember, but most of the donation you get back directly off your income tax. So it's a really good deal. Yeah, anybody who wants to join the Animal Protection Party, please come forward. We'd love to talk to you. I'll probably call you personally if you give a donation, and it would be fantastic.
And do we have to be Canadian to make a donation?
You have to be a Canadian citizen or a there's one other landed immigrant or something. You have to be a Canadian. I think you have to be a Canadian citizen to vote. I don't think you have to be a Canadian citizen to join the party. No.
So, Liz, I think we covered well, the topics at hand, the issues that needed to be addressed surrounding this election and the state of animal rights in Canada. Did you want to add something before we stop the recording?
Yeah, I would just say to everybody who's listening, I understand how hard it is to do this work, to look at the images and to not get discouraged and not feel angry and not, feel unable to do anything. And I just ask you to sit back a little bit and reconsider. The animals that you watched had to undergo that kind of cruelty. But if they encouraged you to become part of the movement and to fight hard for animal rights, then they didn't die in vain. And I would urge you to sit back, reconsider, and join the movement and join the party, whichever you want to do, and fight for the animals, because they sure need our help.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.